it is Monday, May 18th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Samsung Electronics and its largest union are in last-ditch wage talks to avoid a planned 18-day strike, with the dispute centred on bonus payments. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we discuss South Korea's new oil relief handouts, debate over a possible people's dividend, and what Kevin Warsh's confirmation as US Fed chair could mean for rates in Seoul. And on Sports Roundup, we look at the Korea World Cup squad, a historic inter-Korean women's football clash in Suwon, and a big week in the KBO. Let's start Korea 24 right now. We begin today with Samsung Electronics, where the company is facing the prospect of a major labor strike. Labor and management have resumed talks, but it remains unclear whether they can resolve a dispute over bonuses. To bring us up to speed, we're joined now on the line by Nikkei Asia staff writer Stephen Barwick, who has been closely following the issue. Hello, Mr. Barwick.
Hello.
Let's start with what is at the heart of this dispute, and how did the labor conflict begin?
It began when Samsung workers took issue with the bonuses that were being paid out by the company's rival, Hynix, which is another big South Korean chip maker. What they did there was they abolished their bonus pay cap for a period of 10 years, which caused bonuses at this competitor company to be a lot larger than what was being paid at Samsung. And so Samsung workers started to agitate for a similar deal at their own shop. But just a bit more broadly, it's really just about how to divide the spoils of the ongoing boom in AI products. I mean, if you look at export data from South Korea, there's just these constant historic highs that are being hit due to the strong global demand for chips that are made here. And it's creating a lot of revenue for these companies. And it's just, this is just a sign that the workers feel as though they deserve a larger share of what's being created here. And on the other side, Samsung management and some other voices in the society have been arguing that the South Korean economy is at this point quite dependent on the growth fueled by semiconductors. It's creating a lot of tax revenue. It's creating a lot of employment. And it's so that it's therefore a bad time for the workers to be demanding undertaking this push for better compensation. So it's a quite high profile dispute.
Let's delve a bit more into those demands from both sides. What exactly are these unionized workers demanding? And how, of course, is Samsung management responding?
So the union's demands include that Samsung abolish a bonus cap of 50% of their annual salaries and put about 15% of their annual operating profit into a bonus pool that will be distributed to workers. So, I mean, what I think is significant about this is Korean companies have customarily paid out these bonuses, and they tend to be calculated as a percentage of the worker's salary. It might be like 100% of their salary, depending on how the company did that year. But what I think is notable about this is that the workers are asking for something a little bit different. They're asking for a share of the profits. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's significant because this is coming in a sector that's generating these huge profits. And so the workers are saying that they don't want their own bonuses to be limited to what they make as a reflection of their base salary, but they want a percentage of profits, which is kind of a, you know, an unusual labor management arrangement. That's not how companies here or in most other parts of the world work. And, you know, Samsung being South Korea's biggest flagship company, it's reasonable to wonder that if Samsung were to go through with something like this, if the workers were able to achieve this, that it would have a kind of a trickle-down effect that more companies would point to what's happening at Samsung and argue that they want something similar. So what happens at Samsung is not just about Samsung. It's has a lot of broader significance for the economy here.
Mm-hmm. Samsung could potentially be setting a really interesting precedent. Now, fill us in on the latest status of the negotiations between the two sides.
Well, the last bit of news that I saw today was that a court partially accepted Samsung Electronics' request for an injunction. And so what they were trying to do was essentially get the strike deadline is Thursday, May 21st. And I feel like management's goal was to get this court to essentially deem that illegal and therefore be able to stop the workers from carrying out any the 18-day strike. The court accepted, I think, not all, but part of their demands. And the idea is that the court is ordering the workers to keep the facilities functioning at a level that does not compromise safety and that does not result in a complete shutdown. But I mean, what it would do is it would result in production being a lot lower than normal. So the workers still do. The threat of the strike is still real. Perhaps what this injunction might do is limit the effect of it, but the dispute is definitely still ongoing. There are some talks that were going on today, and I believe are scheduled to stretch until tomorrow. So we'll have to see if they're able to reach any kind of agreement there.
Well, as you just mentioned, this strike is set to go ahead on Thursday. That's May 21st, if no agreement is met. The government hinted at the weekend over the possibility of intervention. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, Prime Minister Kim In-suk mentioned that the government could invoke emergency labor mediation measures. And that's a really kind of extreme step. I think that hasn't been done in South Korea in something like 20 years. I think the last time that it was that the government did that was over a labor dispute at Korean Air when pilots were striking. And so that's a kind of extreme step where basically the government would step in and order the parties to keep working to avoid any kind of major work stoppage, even if labor and management have not reached an agreement. I mean, I guess that just speaks to the seriousness with which the government is seeing this. And they're seeing this as a dispute that has the potential to affect some real large scale economic impact. And so I think they're hoping that it doesn't come to that. But I imagine that like the messaging from the government is intended to kind of be in the backs of the minds of both labor and management when they're discussing this to maybe be a little more flexible, maybe work a little bit harder to reach a common ground, just knowing how much is riding on this. Mm-hmm. All eyes will definitely be on Samsung in the coming days.
Absolutely. And we'll continue watching to see whether these talks do lead to a deal before Thursday's planned strike. I'm Stephen Borowick, Nikkei Asia staff writer. Thank you so much for joining us and explaining the latest on the Samsung labor dispute.
Thank you.
And now for the rest of today's headlines, we're joined in the studio by our KBS World Radio News reporter, Bae Ji-yeon. Hello, Ji-yeon.
Hello, Alana.
So President Lee Jae-myung and US President Donald Trump spoke over the phone on Sunday. Tell us, what did they talk about?
According to a presidential office spokesperson on Monday, Trump shared with Lee the results of his recent summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping as an allied nation. Also, during the call that lasted for some 30 minutes, the two leaders held what the spokesperson described as an emphatic exchange on the issue of peace on the Korean Peninsula. The call, initiated at South Korea's request, was the second phone call between the two leaders following their first on June 6th of last year, shortly after Lee took office.
And meanwhile in Washington, the White House says Trump and Xi reaffirmed their shared goal to denuclearize North Korea. Give us the details on that.
In a fact sheet released on Sunday, the White House said the two leaders had reached consensus on several issues, including confirming their shared goal of denuclearizing North Korea. Though it had been reported that the two leaders had discussed North Korea in Beijing, the fact sheet marked the first time either side had confirmed their agreement on the issue.
What were some other highlights of that fact sheet?
It added that Trump and Xi had agreed that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, called on Tehran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, and shared a view that no country or organization can charge tolls for the use of the waterway.
Well, shifting gears to North Korea, its leader, Kim Jong-un, has called for the reinforcement of the frontline units on the country's border with the South. Ji-yeon, what's that about?
According to the North's state-run Korean Central News Agency, Kim said during a meeting with the commanders of the Army's divisions and brigades on Sunday that the advancement of military technology at key units, and particularly frontline forces, was vital in deterring war. Kim highlighted the country's policy of turning the southern border into an impregnable fortress and strengthening the frontline units as he urged the military to continue to heighten awareness against what he called North Korea's arch enemy. The KCNA cited Kim as saying the country plans to remodel the military's organizational structure and strengthen those and other major units as an important decision to more thoroughly deter war. Now let's get the latest on the explosion and fire aboard the HMM Namu in the Strait of Hormuz earlier this month. I understand South Korea's Foreign Minister Cho Hyun has spoken over the phone with his Iranian counterpart on the matter.
Yes, according to Seoul's foreign ministry on Sunday, Cho briefed Iranian Foreign Minister Seyed Abbas Araghchi on the South Korean government's ongoing investigation and its tentative conclusion that the ship was attacked. The minister also stressed the importance of safe and free navigation for all vessels in the strait and asked Araghchi to state Iran's position on the relevant facts. Araghchi outlined Iran's perspective on the current situation in the Middle East and expressed agreement on the need to restore safe transit in the key shipping route by putting an end to confrontations there.
Well, staying on issues related to the Middle East, a fire occurred at the United Arab Emirates Baraka nuclear power plant built by a South Korean consortium led by the state-run Korea Electric Power Corporation, or KEPCO. Jerome, what do we know about this fire?
Well, the UAE says a drone strike is what caused the fire. Abu Dhabi's media office said on social media on Sunday that authorities had responded to a fire at an electrical generator outside the inner perimeter of the Baraka nuclear power plant in the Al Dhafra region. It did not identify the perpetrators of the attack. It added that no injuries were reported and there was no impact on radiological safety levels.
And have we gotten any word from Seoul or KEPCO on this incident?
South Korea's foreign ministry and KEPCO also confirmed there were no casualties involving South Korean workers at the plant. The UAE defense ministry said three drones had entered the UAE from the western border direction. Building the Baraka plant was South Korea's first ever overseas nuclear power plant project.
And for our final story, the official campaign period for the June 3rd local elections and by-elections is scheduled to kick off on Thursday. Jeon, what kind of activities will candidates be allowed or not allowed to do during this period?
Candidates and their camps can deliver speeches in public places from 7 a.m. until 11 p.m. during the campaign period, which will end on June 2nd. However, public address or loudspeaker systems can only be used until 9 p.m., while recording equipment can be used until 11 p.m. if there is no sound output. Candidates and their spouses, election campaign managers, and election campaign staff will be allowed to carry out campaigning activities while wearing sashes, labels, buttons, or branded apparel, like matching tops that will make them easily identifiable to voters.
And when will voters be getting election notices?
The National Election Commission said Monday that it will send those notices by Sunday after putting up election posters submitted by candidates at designated sites nationwide by Friday. The commission stressed that no one can produce, edit, distribute, screen, or post deepfake videos for election campaigns as of 90 days before Election Day, and that sharing or disseminating posts containing defamatory remarks or false information about candidates on social media may violate the law.
And that wraps up today's news briefing. Thank you so much, Jeon, for bringing us the headlines.
Thanks, Alana.
Hi, my name is conductor Holly Hyun Che, or Che Hyun. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The government has begun distributing its second round of cash handouts to the bottom 70% of the population to help South Koreans weather strains from the war in Iran. The first round went to low-income welfare recipients, people living just above the poverty line, and single-parent families. The second round of subsidies, which began on Monday, will go to the remainder of the population, excluding the richest 30%. The so-called oil relief support payments range from 100,000 won, about $66, to 600,000 won per person.
On today's weekly economy review, we'll look at the impact of these handouts, the controversy over people's dividends, and the confirmation of Kevin Warsh as the new US Fed chair. And to help us understand the economic headlines of the week, we're joined now on the line by economics professor Yang Jin-seok of the Catholic University of Korea. Hello, Professor Yang.
Hello.
Well, before we start with the handouts, let's briefly touch on the potential strike at Samsung Electronics, which will begin on Thursday if there is no last-minute compromise. Professor, we've discussed this issue on previous shows, but what do you think will be the impact of a strike at South Korea's largest company?
Okay, well, Samsung's labor union estimates that the cost to Samsung will be about ₩1 trillion per day. So based on that, a lot of analysts are estimating losses from 30 to 100 trillion won. A lot of that comes not just from the direct losses by Samsung, but from lost sales, but also due to loss in consumer confidence, loss in stock prices, and so on. But my guess is that at least the short-term losses will be less than what is being calculated right now, because the U.S. customers want the semiconductors so much that if there's less supply available, the prices will just go up. However, from Samsung's point of view, if they make a legally problematic decision, because the Korean issues with so-called regular pay, they might increase labor costs, not just through the bonuses that they have to pay, but if these bonuses are legally classified as part of regular pay, then they may be stuck with higher overall pay as well as higher pension costs in the future, even when the Samsung Electronics lose money. And then there's also, from the society's point of view, there's probably going to be more income inequality because, well, Samsung workers are going to get a lot more money. But not only that, other companies are looking to a similar type of bonus arrangement. And only the high profit stability companies are going to be able to afford these type of bonuses. So the labor pay for good jobs may be going up even more than it is now, which will worsen income inequality for the country as a whole. And then this might reduce the incentives for people to become an entrepreneur or even a stock investor because they will feel that, well, why should I take a risk when a lot of these profits are going to be taken by labor, because they will get the first cut out of any profits that the company will see. So this may impact not only the stock market, but also future direct investment in Korea, the future entrepreneurship, less entrepreneurship, less companies created, less jobs created.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to wait and see, can any agreement be made before that strike is set to go ahead on Thursday. Let's move on now to our main topic. The government is offering cash assistance to 7 out of 10 Koreans. Professor, how did the government arrive at this threshold?
Well, it was based on economic theory, but the actual 70% line was decided rather arbitrarily and haphazardly. Now, we know that this type of cash assistance is not the most effective policy. If the cash assistance is to be effective, it will have to create new spending, new consumption and investment, not just replacing what consumption and investment would have been anyway, just replacing it with these government cash payouts. Now, what we've seen in the past is that the lower income households tend to spend more, create new spending, new consumption when they receive money from the government. Now, this has been known for a long time. The economist's technical term for it is lower marginal propensity to consume, or higher marginal propensity to consume. So economists have always recommended that if there's this type of cash handouts, and if you cannot find a better way, then it's better to concentrate the assistance on lower income households than higher income households. But why exactly 70%? Well, that was decided more or less politically. So there's no legal or economic rule that says you have to cut it at 70%. In the last year's 2025 cash assistance, it was set at 90% of the income group, actually. So it might be that they reviewed the data and found that the 70% was the ideal cutoff point. But if they did any kind of study, they haven't announced it or publicized it. But this does present a big political change for Lee Jae-myung, President Lee, because he used to advocate universal payments, mm-hmm. payments to everybody. But now he's settling for lower income, 70%. And different amount for different cases. So in this sense, President Lee is has changed his position somewhat drastically.
And Professor, are these cash handouts likely to impact inflation in any way?
For now, I wouldn't think so. And that's not because these cash payments is not inflationary, but because there's already high inflation coming from the Iran war, higher oil prices anyway. So it's probably going to be subsumed under that inflation. You're not going to feel it very much. Mm-hmm. And frankly, Korea hasn't really felt any kind of shortages from the Iran war. There has been prices been going up, but that's mainly because we're afraid that there will be shortages in the future, not right now. Korea's oil reserves are still intact, more or less. Oil is still coming in, and what shortages we may have may be due to hoarding rather than actual reduced supply. Right now, we probably are not going to see that much additional inflationary effect from the cash assistance. But if there is indeed shortages, if there are going to be shortages in oil, shortages in plastic goods and so on, then this type of cash assistance can be very inflationary because, if you don't have enough goods to buy, then you're just going to drive the prices up when you give people money. But I don't think we have arrived at that stage yet. We may see that in the latter half of this year, but it hasn't hit Korean economy yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, this cash support is part of the Lee administration's expansionary fiscal policy. This policy guided remarks last week by presidential policy chief Kim Jong-bum, who suggested a people's dividend could redistribute gains from an AI-led boom. Kim and President Lee Jae-myung later said that this would use excess tax revenue, not a new profit levy. But the comments still rattled the KOSPI and also drew some quite sharp criticism from the opposition. And Professor, I want to ask, what do you make of Kim's statement and how do you think the excess tax should be used?
Okay, to start with the latter question first, how should it be used? We should save it. And the reason for that is that, well, right at the beginning of the year, there was a concern that this year's growth may not be as high as we thought it would be, and that feeling worsened when there was the Iran war started. But right now, everybody has been surprised by Korea's 1.7% growth in the first quarter, and everybody's readjusting the growth rate. Right now, the newer growth rate projections are centering around 2.5 to 2.7. If the growth rate is around that amount, I would say that Korean economy is overheated, not slowing down. So there's no basis to argue that we need more spending. Korean government budget spending this year, even without the supplementary budget, was already highest in its history. So we should try thinking about rearranging some of the items in that budget rather than spending more. But what really concerns me is that if you take this logic, then in a bad year, we have to have deficits because we want the economy to not go into recession. But even in good years, we're going to increase the deficit. So in bad years, we have deficits. In good years, we have deficits. This is going to be unsustainable. Even though we're in a fairly good position right now, if we take this position and we know that the Korean demographics will make Korean deficits worse in the future, so we should save the money when we can and use it later on when we really do get into a bad situation. But if we insist on increasing deficits, even in a good year, then the debt is not going to be sustainable.
Well, on Friday, the president criticized those calling for tighter fiscal policies, citing the IMF's assessment that South Korea's debt situation is relatively favorable compared to those of many other countries. Professor, how do you assess South Korea's debt level?
Okay, well, it's around 50% of the GDP right now. That's not too bad, especially compared with other advanced countries. The problem is, everyone knows that Korean deficits are going to get worse. Korean debt is going to get worse because of Korea's demographic problem. We're going to have a lot more retirees who cannot pay taxes or cannot pay much taxes. We're going to have less younger people who pay into the system. And IMF numbers do not necessarily reflect that. IMF knows the problem. It's just that in order to set an international standard statistics, they do not include some of these items. So I think President Lee has to look at a wider set of statistics. We've known this problem for a long time. If President Lee is not thinking about these demographic problems, then somebody has been giving him some wrong advice.
Well, let's move on now to our third and final topic for today, and that is President Trump's pick to lead the U.S. Federal Reserve, Kevin Warsh. He was confirmed by the Senate last week. Warsh was formerly known as a bit of an inflation hawk, but he has now appeared to be more amenable to a rate cut in the run-up to his nomination. Professor, how do you think Warsh will respond to Trump's demands to lower rates?
Okay, well, the Wall Street seems to be wondering about that themselves. I think he passed the Senate on the strength that he was a deficit hawk. He was an inflation hawk. And he was on record during 2008 and during the Biden administration as saying that the monetary policy was too loose. But having said that, the President Trump does want lower rates. Warsh has said that there was room to lower rates. But right now, current data all favor raising rates rather than lowering them. So if Warsh does lower the rates, I think that'll bring the political independence of the Fed under question. And that may do more harm than good, especially in the stock market and the financial sector, because without that guarantee of political independence, financial investors will be no longer assured that inflation will be controlled and no longer be sure that political pressures, temporary political pressures, may not affect the monetary policy decisions. But you also have to remember that Walsh is one vote among many. There are 12 FOMC voting members. He's only one of them. He does have somewhat more power than the others because he is a chairman. But still, I'm not sure if every other or majority of the FOMC members, except for Stephen Moran, who was selected by President Trump because he wanted to lower rates. Other than Stephen Moran, I'm not sure if he can convince any other members, at least with the current data. But that does not necessarily mean that Walsh will not make its impact felt. Walsh will probably get his wish to have more bank deregulation, elimination or radical revision of how FOMC makes forward guidance on future interest rates. And there's talk that Walsh wants to replace PCE inflation with so-called trimmed PCE inflation as a preferred gauge of inflation. Those probably is going to happen. But for the interest rate in that itself, I think they'll have to wait until they get more favorable data unless they want to they want investors to lose confidence in the Fed.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the topic of rates, as we discussed last week, the Bank of Korea has signaled a rate increase after a year of keeping the rate put. How, if at all, do you think that U.S. rates might impact monetary policy here in Seoul?
Okay, well, as I said, we're not quite sure whether Walsh raised the rates or lowered the rates. Mm-hmm. So let's look at both point of view. Actually, the data does say that if anything, the U.S. as well as Korea should raise rates. if U.S. does raise rates, and if the exchange rate becomes unstable, I noticed that it's hovering somewhat around 1,500 now after being stable for a couple of weeks. Korea may have to raise rates sooner than later if the U.S. raises their rates, because with the exchange rate instability, we cannot afford to really widen the interest rate gap too much between Korea and U.S. If the U.S. lowers their rates, however, it gives Korea some extra time to make its decision, because the differences between Korea and U.S. rates will be lowered. But as I said, right now the data for both Korea and U.S. Seems to favor rate rise rather than a rate fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we're going to wrap up this week's Weekly Economy Review. Our thanks, as always, to Professor Yang Jun-seok of the Catholic University of Korea for joining us. Thank you so much, Professor Yang.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 22.86 points, or 0.31% on Monday, to close at 7,516.04. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 18.73 points, or 1.66%, to close at 1,111.09. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we look at some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Okay, what's our starting point today?
Police announced investigations are underway for an unusual accident that occurred on Saturday involving a car crashing into an indoor swimming pool.
Okay, definitely sounds unusual. Give us a recap of how this accident unfolded.
Sure thing. According to Gyeongnam Provincial Police, at around 10:18 a.m. Saturday, a woman in her 70s reportedly drove her car through a glass wall at the Hanam Sports Center in Miryang, South Gyeongsang Province, and the vehicle fell about 5 meters into the 7-lane indoor swimming pool. The accident happened while the driver, a member of the sports center, was pulling out of the parking lot to head home. Security camera footage of the complex shows the car parked at ground level and facing the building, falling at an almost 90-degree angle, striking the edge of the pool with its hood before flipping onto its roof and into the water.
And Daniel, were any injuries reported?
Around 10 people, including an instructor, were swimming in the pool at the time of the accident, but thankfully, they were out of harm's way as the car fell in a spot quite far away from where they were clustered. One woman was hit by a broken glass that flew off, but only sustained minor scratches. The driver was rescued by those who were in the pool at the time.
Wow.
It must have been a shocking moment, but they were able to shake it off and help rescue the driver. And the instructor even conducted CPR. The driver, she said she experienced some chest pain as she was taken to hospital.
Well, great news that no one was seriously hurt, and so impressive how quickly those bystanders were able to step in to help, especially in such a shocking moment. Do we know anything yet about what may have caused this accident?
Well, the driver said she can't clearly remember what exactly happened before the accident. Inspectors will look into the possibility of DUI as well as mechanical failures like sudden unintended acceleration as the car moved forward through the flower bed located between the parking space and the center's glass wall. They will also look into possible safety lapses on the part of the sports center. While the facility has passed three regular safety inspections since opening in 2024, there was a curb about 10 centimeters separating the parking lot and flower bed, but no fences, boards, or other barriers that could have stopped a vehicle from crashing through the wall. Police plan to question those involved, including the driver, and begin on-site inspections.
Let's move on now to our next story for today.
A Korean horror film titled Salmokji, Whispering Water, became a surprise box office hit this year. It is now the most watched key horror film of all time.
What an achievement. Tell us more about how Salmukji etched itself into Korean movie history books.
Well, it exceeded over 3.17 million audiences by Sunday, according to data by the Korean Film Council. The film about a crew that experiences supernatural events while trying to complete a shoot at a haunted location on time dethroned A Tale of Two Sisters, which previously held the top spot with 3.14 million back in 2003.
And how were the team behind this movie able to create such a winning formula?
If you look at the movie A Tale of Two Sisters, which was the previous record holder, this is a pretty big budget movie featuring superstar actors and actresses in it. Now we live in a world of many franchise films, sequels, adaptations of successful IPs, big budget movies with massive special effects driven by mega star power. And many of such works fail to impress or appear tried and tested. The maestro of Salmukji is a young director that's making his big screen debut. The cast is full of talented newcomers. They had the backing of a production company that reportedly gave them free reins. Other than solid acting and storytelling, the team turned to a familiar ghost story or urban legend and gave it a modern twist by incorporating digital media such as map apps, 360-degree cameras, and YouTube filming equipment.
And Daniel, aside from attracting people to cinemas, of course, to watch the movie, did the horror film's impact go beyond theaters?
Well, since the movie premiered on April 8th, Salmukji Reservoir in Yesan County, South Chungcheong Province, has rapidly become one of South Korea's most unique tourist hotspots. From what used to be an ordinary reservoir occasionally visited by anglers, it has become a must-visit spot for fans of the urban legend or the movie itself. It's great to enjoy such influx of visitors, but some experts do warn of the downsides of permanently positioning the location as something only associated with urban legends, and that excessive commercialization of such an eerie image marketing should be approached cautiously.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's now turn the spotlight to today's final story.
Globally renowned filmmaker Park Chan-wook received the highest cultural honor given by the French government.
Okay, tell us more about the award and the significance of Park earning this honor.
Well, Park received France's Commander in the Order of Arts and Letters, the highest rank of the three-tier honor from the French Ministry of Culture, in a ceremony presided over by French Culture Minister Catherine Brigard on Sunday local time. He becomes only the fourth Korean to receive the prestigious award, standing shoulder to shoulder with fellow legends including conductor Chung Myung-hun and soprano Josumi.
And was this an especially meaningful award for this highly decorated filmmaker?
Yes, it was. Park said his works received tremendous influence from French films and philosophy, and that he also expressed how deeply touched he is to see how his works now seem to be influencing young French filmmakers. Park also mentioned that his last remaining wish is to film a movie in France with French actors someday.
And aside from receiving this honor, Diana, remind us what's keeping Park busy in France.
Well, the ceremony did take place on the sidelines of the 79th edition of the Cannes Film Festival, where Park is leading the jury as the first Korean to assume the role. Park's close ties to France and the Cannes Film Fest dates all the way back to 2004, when he won the Grand Prix with the film Old Boy. He said that his close ties with the film festival have continued to grow from then on. Park won the jury prize for Thirst in 2009 and received the Best Director Award for Decision to Leave in 2022.
And that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for Sports Roundup, your weekly look at all the action from the big wins and tough losses to the stories making headlines on and off the field. And joining us now on the line to help us do that, we have our regular contributor, sports reporter Yoo Ji-ho from Yonhap News Agency. Hi, Ji-ho.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good, Ji-ho. We're talking World Cup to kick things off today, the 2026 FIFA World Cup. It's just under a month away. And South Korea's 26-man squad was unveiled Saturday. So let's jump right in and talk about head coach Hong Myung-bo's team.
Sure. Well, not a lot of surprises for Hong, who will take three forwards, three goalkeepers, 10 midfielders and 10 defenders to the World Cup in Mexico, where Korea will play all three group stage matches. Son Heung-min, a no-brainer choice, will remain captain for this national team. He will make his fourth World Cup appearance, and that will tie him with Hong, Hwang Son-hong, and Lee Eun-jae for the most World Cup appearances, World Cup tournaments by a Korean player. Veteran goalkeepers Cho Hyun-woo and Kim Sung-kyu made the team once again. Cho beating out Kim for the top job back in 2018, and then they flipped the tables. Kim won the number one job over Cho in 2022. So they're going to go back at it once again, trying to win that number one goalkeeping job for South Korea. One major surprise came from the back line, as Gangwon FC defender Lee Gi-hyuk earned his first World Cup call-up despite having just one international cap to his name, and that was from 4 years ago with that. And Hong said he liked Lee Gi-hyuk's versatility as someone who can play as center back, as the midfielder, and also as a left fullback. And Gangwon, you know, his team have been the stingiest defense in the K-League 1 this season, giving up just 14 goals in 10 matches. And Lee Gi-hyuk has been an integral part of that defense.
So mostly a pretty familiar-looking squad. Son leading the way into his fourth World Cup. But that Lee Gi-hyuk surprise call-up, I think, will definitely give fans one fresh storyline to watch. Ji-ho, are there any other names that we should be keeping an eye on from this squad?
Sure. Well, we have the usual suspects like Lee Kang-in, Kim Min-jae, Lee Jae-sung, and some up-and-coming young forwards, young attackers, and guys like Yang Hyun-jun, Oh Hyung-kyu, and Pae Jun-ho. And of course, we have to talk about Yance Castro, the first foreign-born player of a mixed heritage to make a Korean men's World Cup team. He was born in Germany to a Korean mother and a German father. He plays with a little bit of an edge. He got him in trouble a little bit during the Bundesliga season for his German club, you know, getting ejected a couple of times. But he does bring a bit of a different dimension to the team as far as the midfielder course is concerned. Hwang In-beom got the call-up despite suffering an ankle injury in March that ended his Dutch league season prematurely. He's been rehabbing with the help of national team medical staff. And Coach Hong said Hwang's conditioning level is even better than some of the other players. He just has to regain his match sharpness in time for the World Cup. So overall, out of 26 players, 13 have met the first World Cup team. And not all of them will play, but they will still gain just by training with the national team ahead of the big tournament.
Definitely a nice mix of familiar stars and fresh faces. And what does the training schedule look like for Team Korea from here and on out?
Yeah, so Hong and his staff, plus a few players chosen from the domestic K-League or a couple of guys from the second division in England whose seasons have ended, you know, they've been staying in Korea. So they're going to travel to Salt Lake City, Utah for training camp. And Korea will play two of their three matches in the high altitude of Guadalajara in Mexico. So players will try to get themselves acclimatized in high altitude conditions in another high city of Salt Lake City. The rest of the team, the players based in Europe, China, Japan, or in case of Son Heung-min in Los Angeles, will join the national team next week. Korea will play two friendly matches while they're in Utah. First against Trinidad and Tobago at 10 a.m. May 31st in Korean time, and El Salvador at 10 a.m. June the 4th. And the following day, they're going to travel to Mexico to set up their Mexico World Cup base camp in Guadalajara. First match in Korean time will be the 11 a.m. June the 12th against Czechia.
Well, we're going to stick with football because the much-anticipated showdown between women's football clubs from South Korea and North Korea will take place just south of Seoul this week. Ji-ho, give us a preview of that AFC Women's Champion League semi-finals that's set for Wednesday evening.
Yep, Suwon FC Women of South Korea and Naegohyang Women's FC of North Korea will square off for a chance to compete in the final of the AFC Women's Champions League. The kickoff will be 7 p.m. Wednesday at Suwon Stadium. Naegohyang players arrived in South Korea yesterday after training for a few days in Beijing. Their official training session plus the press conference will be Tuesday. The other semifinal will be between Melbourne City and Nippon TV Tokyo Verde Velasa of Japan. There will be no third place match. The final will be 2 p.m. Saturday, also at the Suwon venue. And this is only the second year for the AFC Women's Champions League. They're trying to build this into a prestigious women's club tournament of Asia. And Suwon FC Women actually knocked off the defending champions, Wuhan and Jiangda of China, in the quarterfinals. Negohyang, they also won their quarterfinals match pretty handily. They actually defeated Suwon 3-0 in their group stage match back in November last year. Negohyang are the first North Korean women's football club to play south of the border.
So it's a historic matchup in Suwon. And as you said, I'm sure Suwon FC women will be looking for a bit of redemption after that group stage loss. Of course, Jiho, it goes without saying there's going to be tons of eyeballs on this match. I saw a video from the airport in Incheon of the team arriving and, you know, just packed with media. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the stands at Suwon Stadium are also going to be packed with fans cheering on both clubs.
Yeah, so some 7,000 tickets available for the general public were all snatched up within about 12 hours going on sale last week. The Asian Football Confederation is scrambling also to accommodate a large throwing of media as well. The remaining about 2,000, 3,000 tickets will be distributed to civic groups of South Korea who will form cheering squads for both teams. I think it's going to be a little bit awkward to see a group of fans cheering for both sides in a club competition where teams are vying for $1 million prize money come final on Saturday. Suwon will be playing on the home soil, but actually technically they're the visiting team in this matchup. Negohyang will be the home team, designated as the home team. And you know what? I think Suwon might end up feeling like they are the visiting team also, with all so much attention being paid to the North Korean side. And, you know, most likely the tournament would not have drawn so much attention without the presence of Negohyang. And it's a unique situation considering the political situation on the peninsula. The AFC has urged all stakeholders to, you know, at least try to keep this a strictly a sporting event and leave politics out of it. But the Korean government has already stepped in. You know, they're dipping into the inter-Korean exchange fund to help finance the cheering squads as far as buying the tickets, purchasing props for cheering and all that. So, you know, it's hard to keep politics out of this when the teams from the two Koreas actually play each other.
Mm-hmm. A sellout crowd, you know, huge media interest. And as you said, Jiho, it is hard to keep that political subtext at bay. So I'm sure it'll be an interesting match. We'll move on to some baseball now. In the KBO League, the two teams vying for first place will collide this week. They've been moving in opposite directions in recent days. Give us a bit of a preview of the week ahead in Korean baseball.
Yeah, so Samsung Lions will host the KT Wiz for three games in their alternate home of Pohang, which is a little bit east of their main home city of Daegu. The Wiz are clinging to first place by a half game over the LG Twins and one game over the Samsung Lions. The Wiz walked off to Hanwha Eagles on Sunday, but they've just got three wins in their past 10 games. The Lions lost Sunday, but they've got seven wins in the last 10. They have a chance to overtake the Wiz for first place with the series starting Tuesday. The Twins can also climb to first place depending on how the Wiz and Lions series goes. They play the Kia Tigers and the Kyum Heroes this week. But the hottest team this month, at least in terms of the offense, has been the Hanwha Eagles. They've scored 120 runs. They've had 29 home runs so far this month. And no other team even has 100 runs or even 20 homers this month. So it's usually not that sustainable to rely on offense to keep winning games, but you know, they're trying to ride the wave while they can. They're now just two games below 500 in the winning percentage.
A big week at the top of the KBO standings, and the KBO League is also closing in on that 4 million fans for the season and will likely do so in record-breaking fashion as well. Jiho, tell us more about that.
Yeah, so through Sunday's action, just about 3.88 million fans have attended the KBO games. And at this rate, the 4 million milestone will be reached sometime this week. The KBO has cleared every million mark in the fewest games ever so far this season. 55 games to get to 1 million, 117 to 2 million, 166 to 3 million, 211 games in the books so far. The record, the fastest to 4 million is 230 games last year, and I think we're going to do it within 220 at least this season. Also, so far, out of 211, KBO has had 126 sellouts. The record for a season is 331 from last year. We're just about halfway there already, so I think that sellout record is also in danger this year.
Mm-hmm. Looks like a lot of records are going to be broken. That's where we'll leave it for this week's Sports Roundup. That was sports reporter Yuji Ho from Yonhap News Agency bringing us the latest. Thanks so much, Jiho.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's Korea 24. But be sure to join us again tomorrow for more news, analysis and stories from Korea and beyond. I'm Alana Hill. Take care and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.